I'm going to continue on the Satipatthana Sutta, particularly focusing on Kaya Nupassana, contemplation of body. Now, I've always been told that, a good talk starts with telling what I'm going to say, and then saying it, and then saying what I said. And I used to be quite a bit more linear. And I don't know if it's age or change inwardly, but, I just can't seem to do that. I can't seem to say what I'm going to say because I don't know what I'm going to say. And then after I said it, I'm not sure what I said. Fortunately, you have other linear teachers around, such as Michelle. In Polynesia and Micronesia, there are many styles of fishing, and one style is one person, one woman or man, has a throw net. It's all stacked in a certain way, and they use a soft-eyed gaze to kind of see beneath the surface shadows and light, and then throw the net out, spreads out in a big circle, and you pull it back in. And you never know what you might get or not. That's my feeling every time I sit up here. The other morning, I had a good meditation, and I shared it. I shared what my experience was, and it triggered in you what you have already inside of you. That's talking about something about making mindfulness like a mist in the marrow of your bones, feeling it from there, and then going not up, but down, even deeper, even more subtle than that. And that's and then at the end, if you remember, it was such a stillness amongst all of you, there was nothing to say. That stillness is samadhi, or insight samadhi, vipassana samadhi. Very fluid, like water, very supple-minded, a true sense of mind-body unification. The gathering together of the mind that is often distracted. I'm going to keep the theme of this stillness and try re-educate us some on our associations with the usual translation of samadhi as concentration. A couple of years ago, I took our daughter Chandra and a spiritual son of Michelle's and mine. His family lives up the road. He's now a monk. And he was 23 then, and Chandra maybe 27 or 8. I took a year off, went to Siberia, and went to a land, a province above Mongolia called Tuva. They're well known there for this ancient shamanic based throat singing, where they can take two or three chords from their throat at once, a real low, deep one, like you might associate with a Tibetan chants, and a mid-range and a very shrill, high one. If you hear it and not see the person, You don't think it's human. You think it's an instrument of some sort. And the Tzaltz Tuva has, you know, remnants and isolated areas where that Stalin didn't get to in his 72-year reign of terror, in which most of the Buddhists and shamans were killed or put in labor camps. In Mongolia alone, 700 monasteries razed to the ground. But you can't kill, you know, the spirit. And so we went there to see its re-arising. Only in the last 10 years, people have been able to get to these more remote places in Siberia. So we went there. There's a friend who does Vipassana from St. Petersburg, Russian friend, which was really essential for translation. Certainly no great tourist places to stay, even in Kaigul, the capital of Tuva. And then from there, we went further out, either by car or, in one case, a three-hour ride in this really frightening helicopter that had there were wires hanging all over the place. And it was dated back to the 60s. They said these things can last forever. But I basically tried to hold my breath for 3 hours. And but we made it to just not far from the border of Mongolia. And this helicopter comes 2 times a week. So it left, and we stayed with a village head family, a woman and man. He was running for mayor. There's no hotels, you know, rest houses or guest houses or restaurants. And, you know, in fact, he was on his way to Kaigul. He was going to get on the helicopter going back and just in a moment changed his mind to host us. And so there we had, you know, live performances in his home from these Tuvan throat singers. And every night there was some, you know, incredible show, a performer who could sing these kind of Indian soul ballads and Mongolian folk dance performances and Tuvan, ancient Tuvan recreations of the great Tuvan commander for Genghis Khan. And it was just amazing and fascinating. And then one day we went out on horses, Chandra, Jake, and I, and our the man of the home and our translator. And about 3 hours out, it began to rain and then thunder and then lightning. And we were crossing everything you can imagine about Siberia. Well, for me, all I could ever imagine before I went there is tundra. But there's swamp, there's forests, there's mountains. And so we just kept going because we couldn't turn back at this point. And so then we were advised to find shelter because of the intensity and lightning was striking around us. So we kept going, and at one point, you know, there was a cabin with some of the indigenous folk, another 5 miles out or something. So we had to go through this swamp, and then we had to cross this stream that had a bridge. The bridge was underwater. It was broken and underwater. And the headman of the village just acted like it was nothing, you know. Come along, come on. And the horses, too, seemed to know what to do. And the water was up to our waists on the horses and just could still hear the clanking of their hoofs on the broken bridge. And it was almost like they were floating for a while. I don't know how it happened, but we got to the other side and finally found by nightfall this cabin and these rural folk. And Chandra was the only woman among eight of us, and the cabin was about as big as your room where you're sleeping. But they had a fire, you know, and it was warm inside. It started to get really cold. In fact, it was a early Siberian snowstorm on the mountains. You could see the next morning. And they went out, and within an hour they came back and had food. And I just, I don't know where they got it, but they got it and fed us. And that night we were talking about the tens of thousands of years of history, you know, in Siberia. And to start talking about in both the Buddhist tradition, which went, you know, up to the top of Siberia, to the north and all the way down to Sri Lanka, all the way west to Afghanistan, maybe even further, all the way east, Japan, Korea, China. So, you know, here we were in a land where Buddhism had been for probably at least 1,500 years or longer, and shamanic practices at least 50,000 years or longer. And they both had similar concepts about stillness or silence. And there's an old shamanic phrase they use to describe that kind of inner silence, stillness, from which, out of that stillness and emptiness, reality is seen. Things as they are can be seen. And how they described it was an idiom, a Siberian idiom that means, I'll describe the form the idiom takes. The form the idiom takes is in the cold of winter, which it already felt like it was, but, you know, it was only down to freezing. Here in Siberia, it can be as cold as 90 degrees below zero. And so when people go outside then, these Tuvans were telling us, when they breathe, as soon as their air comes out, it freezes into these crystals. And then they commingle and tingle like bells to the ground. You know, and in this powerful vastness of stillness of the Siberian winter, the tingling and the silence that commingle, they call the whispering of the stars. Beautiful image. I forget the Siberian or the Tuvan term, but the whispering of the stars. And so the other morning's meditation was taking us to that level of silence and stillness where we start to feel, even between the molecules of our body, and to become aware of just energy flows within. And then in that stillness and subtlety, we notice how subtle awareness itself can be, how subtle the mind can be. The first evening, first talk I gave, I think I described in the shamans of Polynesia, the Polynesian navigators, and Mao, the masterful, elderly Micronesian master, telling the young student Nainoa to keep the vision of the island in mind, you know, to keep the goal in mind, so as not to lose the way. But then, along with the vision comes the total necessity of presence, of being in the present moment, and being aware through the six senses of everything that occurs moment to moment. You know, and using our sense, all six senses, the six being the mind, particularly the intuitive mind, to tune in to what's around. to our surround. And, you know, this way they were able to realize this mutual interconnectedness with everything around them and read the map of the turbulent systems, the various currents, wind patterns. And I think I described, you know, the clouds, migration of birds and fish and colors of the sky and so forth. It clears the way for us to see, you know, the path that we're going, to take the pauses when necessary and realign our motivation and intention for the vision. But, you know, gradually both vision and practice, actual sailing, merge into one. You know, the goal, the journey becomes the goal. And in the same way, we start off with the instructions from the meditation and from the Satipatthana Sutta and gain certain understanding. You know, Joseph and I have been reading the definition, the path of definition, refrain, and then going into each of those in depth in different ways. And then starting with the body, breath, postures, activities I've been addressing. Now's the point, after 3 weeks, where, and the other morning was sort of an affirmation of that to me, where goal, you know, vision and practice now have merged. So, you know, the second level of Satipatthana is when the practice takes over. You know, we no longer need as much instruction, just a little guidance along the way. It's more of a, you know, up-leveled Satipatthana, where it is the Satipatthana itself that is of primacy. It's the guide that does the practice through us. And we just pay attention, just lay back, relax more and more, and let all the experience just come forward into awareness, to be seen, to be known. It takes a tremendous amount of courage, tremendous amount of sacrifice of what usually are our, you know, safety and security places, usually places of, you know, attachment, just the images we hold of ourselves and others and our comforts, comforts we're used to at home, our opinions and views, particularly the attachment to the idea of ourselves. A great deal of courage in relinquishing that. And there's a sense of the mutual connection among us all that, you know, the gift of our own stillness and silence and sila is a benefit to everyone here, at least to everyone here in the hall and at IMS and however else it goes out. An inspiring, a long time inspiring story to me. It happened over a quarter of a century ago. Still connected to Polynesia, and keep getting asked to tell more stories about Polynesia, which I love to do. So I haven't told this one for a long time. When you visit Hawaii, well, nowadays, it doesn't just have to be Hawaii. In Stockholm, Bangkok, Vancouver, and different places in North America, I've seen these bumper stickers that say Eddie would go. There's bumper stickers, there's T-shirts, there's board shorts. They say Eddie would go. And, you know, most people wonder, well, who's Eddie? Where is he going? Or where did he go? Eddie Aikau was one of the crew members of the Hokulea. on its second voyage. And he was known, you know, as a young and great Hawaiian water person who quit school at 16 to be a lifeguard, went out to the North Shore, the biggest waves in the world, biggest riding waves in the world. And there he, you know, saved hundreds of lives. He didn't keep records. And, you know, he was known as really bold with waves and really able to read the waves. He first became known, you know, on a particular day. It was a Wednesday in the 70s, now known as Big Wednesday. And it was off Waimea Bay in the North Shore. And indeed, the waves were just getting, in the morning they were 20 feet, and afternoon 25, 30, 35. Just a handful of very skilled big wave surfers. And Eddie was 50 yards or so, 50, 75 yards further out than the little group of people who were in the pocket area. That is, you know, where the wave comes and looms to a certain steepness where it's possible to catch it. But he was further outside, and most likely some of the people inside were thinking, well, he's just sitting out there like what they call in Australia, teabag. You know, they bob up and down, and they want to be seen out there, but they don't want to catch those waves. But Eddie was anything but a teabag. And he probably sensed that there'd be a big set. And there was. And he was there for it. And he caught, I forget if it was the second or third, it was the biggest of the set, clearly 40 feet. All the other people inside got crunched by the waves. You know, and from the shore, just this roar went up. Who's that, you know? Who's that in the red shorts? And someone said, it's Eddie, streaking down, you know, torquing his body into the wave to stay close to it as it, you know, 35 feet above him, and he made the wave. And from that day on, he became a legend. Saved many, many lives, and, you know, continued to become a great surfer as he grew out of his teens into his 20s. And after the first Hokulea voyage, Nainoa, our friend and the first Hawaiian navigator, asked if he was interested, you know, in being part of it. And Eddie said, I want to go down and help pull Tahiti out of the sea. I want to know and honor the dignity of my ancestors. So they set sail. After several sort of aborted attempts because of weather, finally they went under various pressures. It was the wrong time. You know, between Oahu and Molokai, which is about 27 miles in the middle there somewhere, gale, force storm came up, 15-foot swells. The double-hull canoe flipped entirely over. 19 women and men clinging, like sea snails, you know, to the bow of the boat. And this went on for 8 hours, all through the night, late into the next morning. Finally, Eddie, who had his favorite board strapped to the boat, you know, the communications, everything went down. Nobody knew where they were. And they started to drift out of the line of sight of the both the air cargo planes and passenger planes and boats. So the captain finally gave permission for Eddie to paddle toward about 12 miles toward, you know, the far-off, misty-looking Lanai. 12 miles may not seem far, but with 15-foot swells, he only had to paddle a few seconds and he was out of sight. Going up one wave in the near near distance, they saw him take off his life vest because it was hindering his paddling. But he was tied to his surfboard. But he was never seen again. It was the last time Eddie would go. He, paid the ultimate sacrifice for his friends. Later on that day, the rest of the crew were rescued and taken back. But it was like a lightning bolt, striking the community of the Polynesian Voyaging Society. And at the same time, his death and his very quickly rising legend became the ray of hope to rescue the Polynesian Voyaging Society's mission, of cultural renaissance and spiritual renaissance for Hawaii and all of Polynesia. And people gathered around, and mourned, and then planned, far more safety-minded standards to go about any future sales. And it took 3 years or so before they made another attempt, successful. And now they've done over 100,000 nautical miles, completed the full Polynesian Triangle, including Rapa Nui, Easter Island. I'll tell that another time. Nainoa said Eddie rescued all of that sense of hope that people had begun to place in a voyage that was only supposed to happen once, but then kind of created an awakening. And his courage, his sacrifice, the response to the tragedy, and people kind of taking responsibility for that, all very powerful spiritual elements. And why I've always, regarded these voyages, these outer voyages, and the Polynesian voyage's own mission, that it's not just an outer voyage, it's an inner voyage of discovery. And now they use a lot of their voyages, such as right now, as we speak, to sail from island to island. There's several hundred in the Hawaiian archipelago, and documenting, what they see, which is a lot of pollution, and a lot of change in the sea life, a lot of choked monk seals and turtles endangered by floating nets and things they've swallowed that aren't organic, and doing quite an incredible job of that and bringing that to awareness, that then is often, they have a live connection by satellite with the schools, many schools, and so there's kind of daily communication between what goes on. It's quite inspiring what's happening. So I use that as an example, whenever we're feeling the need to call up, courage, the word in the Pali, wirya, courageous energy. It follows from our faith, our confidence in the practice, and gives us the inspiration and is the underlying support and driving engine of mindfulness. So to visit that as often as we need to, any of these great spiritual faculties and qualities, we can call them up. We can begin to observe them in the mind. We can feel them in the body. We can feel the body greatly affected by that courageous energy. When we sit through difficulty, or even when we sit through bliss without attachment. So in some ways, there's a progression of the Satipatthana contemplations. For example, in the body progresses in awareness from just the ordinary fundamental experience of of breath, postures, activities. And it drops down more into the elemental nature, the more subtle elements described as earth, water, fire, air, experienced as softness, hardness, and cohesion and fluidity, heat and cold, vibration, and support. And as I was sort of guiding the other morning, you can go deeper than that. And I'll talk about that sort of incrementally tonight and next week as well. But it sets the stage for the second foundation, feelings. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feelings, which at first can appear very strong, pronounced, predominant, obvious. It's really pleasant, it's really unpleasant. Neutral is more difficult, but really significant for awakening the mind. If we don't pay attention to neutral feelings, we're cultivating ignorance, delusion in the mind. And therefore, everything we see becomes a fiction if we look through the eyes of delusion. So it's important to start recognizing the kind of feeling tone that has no particular intensity of pleasant or unpleasant. Feeling tone also becomes more and more subtle. Feeling tone, of course, as it relates both to the body and the mind. So as body subtlety arises, as mental subtlety arises, consciousness, awareness itself, so too does the feeling tone and its nature. It teaches us so much about anicca, impermanence, so fleeting. And as we get near it, as awareness gets near it, it's like suddenly we can be swept into the actuality, and all that's known is this incredible stream, sometimes of great velocity or just dissolution of the whole body, mind, energy field and awareness. And then the mind states, again, we recognize the healthy ones, the unhealthy ones, the more predominant, obvious, grosser mind states, the mind with lust or without it, with anger or without it, and expanded or contracted, diluted or clear, distracted or focused. But then too, it goes to subtler levels. The most subtle aspects of the stream of consciousness, the space between the stream of mind. And the awareness of all other phenomena, that fourth foundation of dhammas. They represent, as I've said, certain categories of supporting or hindering calm and insight. And also the Four Noble Truths themselves as something to be realized. But just as dhammas, they too get to a level of extraordinary subtlety. And then out of the stillness, we see this as-it-is-ness nature of things. Yathabhuta in the Pali. Yathabhuta. Things as they are. The nature of things as they are. Something like what in the Zen tradition they call the suchness of things. And so then, in one sense, there is this sense of progression, yet really there's a simultaneous application of all four foundations of mindfulness every time we notice a breath or mind moment of happiness or calm or restlessness. They arise moment to moment and not sequentially. What is sequential is that movement from sort of more gross level awareness and objects to subtler and subtler levels of both awareness and objects. And sometimes as the awareness grows more subtle, then what's noticed is subtle phenomena of body and mind. At other times, then it seems that all mind-body phenomena are becoming very, very still and subtle. And that becomes the condition for awareness to drop to that level. You know, so the other morning, we could have started either way. We started with the body, but we might have started with awareness as the anchor and move that into the body. We started with the body and then brought awareness forward. Doesn't really matter. What matters is the mutual supportiveness of both the awareness and the phenomena that we're being aware of, that one can inform the others. I think I was talking a lot last week about how things in the body can reveal to awareness, to the mind, that this experience of who we are is radically different than the idea about it, the interpretation of it, what we might read of it. You know, someone today was describing something that was very insightful, and that, but, and she said, but it didn't match, you know, what I had read before about that degree, you know, of subtle molecular cellular level awareness. And I said, well, what you read is just conceptual, and it's giving you an idea of what you're supposed to experience, which is not the experience yourself. You know, it's not the experience itself. Let go of what you know, of what you hear, of what you read, and really begin to trust on that level of deep intuitive knowing more and more. And so that higher level satipatthana then is taking over. It's a practice that begins to do itself. It's often mentioned how the Buddha and the Arhants sat all the time, every day, and often anchored, you know, using the body as a pillar of mindfulness. That you don't meditate to get somewhere, you know, and then it's finished. That, yes, there's deeper understanding. Yes, there's more and more shedding of the conditionality, you know, the habitual way in which we live our lives, and the suffering that we cause from the habituation process and identification. But sitting is always beautiful, even when the mind is completely free of all clinging and all attachment, all fear, all delusion. So the body's a relevant practice even for the fully liberated being. And we don't want to think of it as something that we move on from. Now we've done the body, you know, now I should really just watch the mind more. You're going to lose half your life, half of your experience, you know, with that attitude of doing that. So this is an integration to a single practice. All four satipatthanas, they're always happening. Even though there's a skillful means in carefully describing, you know, because it's like throwing that net out. And, you know, one benefit of the non-linear approach, just throw a bunch of seeds out there. And if I don't have to explain everything or connect all the dots, different ones of you will get just what you need. Sometimes if it's over-explained or I connect the dots for you, you know, really the message is right to the heart. The message is right to the Dhamma center in all of you. So last week I did read from the sutta about postures, standing, sitting, walking, lying, and there's really no one posture any better than the other. In one monastery I knew of, in the early 80s, practicing in Burma, my teacher was telling me about this monk who had been diagnosed with an incurable disease. And so he sat, reaching a stage of insight, awakening, or insight, understanding, in which it often has a secondary benefit of healing the body, you know, purifying the blood and healing various conditions of the body. So this happened to him, and because that was his experience, he attracted people to his monastery, you know, that were the incurables or who couldn't do standard practice. And he'd begin by sitting with them for 5 or 10 minutes, just breathing with them, you know, and that's all they'd have to do. And find out what's wrong with them and said, well, your practice should be lying down. Your practice should be standing. That's, in fact, where his practice is. It was said he could stand mindfully for 12 hours and lie down mindfully without falling asleep or even getting lethargic mind for 25 hours at a time. That doesn't mean that that's what we have to do. But it's inspiring to know, you know, that this form is a vehicle. It's relative, and it's meant to conform to each of us in our practice. So, you know, sometimes people are discovering that they're more mindful at this retreat, at this time, walking. You know, so we might personally encourage them to walk more. Or they start getting distracted. Might say, well, just stop and just stand. And begin by just feeling your feet on the ground. You know, and then you can sweep up from your feet through the body. Try to feel the body in the body as described in the Satipatthana Sutta, which means to not self-reference the experience of the body, not identify. Feeling the body within the body is just awareness and the nature of the body as experienced moment to moment. So much emphasis is placed, you know, on the sitting posture only. And also, it's conditioning sometimes around don't move. Really, what we don't want you to move is your mindfulness. You have to move the body, move the body. You know, because sometimes if you don't, that way you lose the stillness and the mindfulness. You can sustain the stillness and mindfulness and still move, you know, when the body gets to a place of aggravation and where it starts to become a distraction. At other times, you just have the energy for it and it just feels right. And you sit through the body feeling like it's on fire. You know, and it's not a chronic energy problem or anything like that. It's just the heat of the sankharas, of the phenomena of mind and body in purification. And you sit with that. So who knows for how long. But a wisdom moment inside might then suggests enough. You know, and then you come out of that. Someone was asking today, you know, that as so many of you over the years have expressed, you know, you kind of get very near to something and you feel this tremendous energy or pressure inside or outside. And all of a sudden, things as you ordinarily perceive them mentally or through the eye door, ear door, start to change and take on these sort of phantasmagoric motions, and nothing seems as it should be. This is often a place where conceptual form is falling away, where the conditioned mind that places everything in categories, in an analytic form or interpretation, you know, as concepts do, the whole sort of conceptual field dissolves. It can be a scary moment. And here, encouragement from us is very useful in letting, you know, kind of understanding that this is a Dhamma fear. It's a natural fear. It's not a bad fear. And the kind of fear that often is a precursor to deep insight experience. And anything can happen, I was saying to one yogi today. Anything can happen. And the yogi kept saying, "Are you sure?" Anything can happen? And I said, "Yeah, anything can happen." Not to be afraid, you know, to notice the fear and let yourself go into it more. And sometimes the body just sort of sometimes starts shaking uncontrollably or jerks here and there. That's pretty minor compared to what can happen. But those... It's true. We all have stories about... I won't go into them, but... and quite literally, often, things are just being shaken off. You know, I've been speaking a little bit every talk about these trauma folds or trauma echoes. And in deep practice, because of all of our innate urge, not our thinking mind, but innate urge toward healing, fulfillment, and liberation, brings these to the surface. Why? Well, because there's a readiness. There's a strength of mind, the virya, the courage, courageous energy. There's confidence, sadda. There's the awareness that can hold it, that can expand around anything at times. You know, there's the stillness that's the refuge. You can always lay in. And there's the understanding, you know, there's the wisdom mind, intuitive wisdom mind that begins to understand, which means we don't identify that these are just old locked up energy pockets that along with the, you know, traumatic folds, there's huge release of zest for life, enthusiasm, joy, delight, passion. Healthy passion. I was talking about some of the trauma stuff that I discovered both in meditation and working with healers. And over the years, I've kind of come to understand, like, the body is, it's like the ocean, it's like space, it's like so many things that on a very subtle level we begin to identify. For example, you know, deeper than the normal sensations we might ordinarily notice is a kind of pulsation that can run in parts, or even the whole body can feel like a pulsation. Pulsation and awareness, nothing else. I've felt a lot of these electromagnetic currents and coils of energy. Again, when that sort of conceptual framing falls away with deeper stillness and sustained continuous mindfulness, you know, we begin to feel these currents. We begin to feel, it feels like tides in the body, ebbing and flowing tides. You can sit there, you know, for an hour or for hours, and just feel this motion, tidal motion in the body. And it has a, you know, remarkable effect in the purification of both the mind and the body. A kind of energy continuum flow. And I don't know how else to describe them. They're my own words, and they all sound like the same thing, but they're not. A continuum flow. In fact, not so long ago, there was a nature program. You know, I saw it on some airplane or hotel around the world somewhere. And, you know, just kind of mindlessly channel surfing or whatever. And there's this program, a very, very close photography of a mold, about a foot-long mold. Mold is made up of all these bacteria, each bacteria being its own individual being, entity. But they're all connected by all that fuzzy stuff. And the photograph showed this continual flow from one end to the other and back. That's all, you know, continual flow, never stopped. What's that? Streaming, like a river streaming. Another thing that can be experienced, again, on these very subtle levels, you know, for moments at a time, even, not necessarily for long periods. And none of this is in any way I'm suggesting to strive for. But I'm saying, if they happen, don't disregard them. Don't think they're nothing. Just because they're subtle. We are quite heavily conditioned, you know, to find something and report something. Never mind. Don't write it down. Forget about it. And if you forget about it, you know, and can't report it to the teacher, good. It's okay. What's most important is that experience of it. And it may be wordless, speechless, ineffable. There's nothing to say. That's how subtle it can be. Vibrating, kind of a global vibrating. Usually, at one time or another, you know, we all experience this whole body as this vibration. And it doesn't seem to be any sense of where it stops and the space around us begins. So it's just vibrating and the awareness of it. Waves. And I'm not saying that just because I'm a surfer. You can feel, you know, wavy energy kind of moving through the body, different than the tidal shifts, different than the electromagnetic current, then vibrating, then streaming, then pulsation. You know, all different kind of unique yet subtle body nature. Real, it's real. It's what the body really is. It's what's meant by body in the body. Why is it real? Because it's a felt experience. Our awareness can know it. It's not real because it's written down or it's said to be so by anyone. It's real because you can experience it. All of us can experience it. This Danish physicist, some of you would have heard of, Niels Bohr, he discovered that when nuclear particles are split, they move away in opposite directions from each other at the speed of light. interesting enough. But the amazing thing is that these particles mirror each other. So that as soon as one, you know, turns left and turns right, exactly simultaneously, the other one also turns left, turns right. This is kind of moving into a wider perception, change or shift of perception in our practice, where, you know, like in these particles, there's nothing perceivable connecting those two particles. But what it suggests is that we're all intimately connected to all of life. Because, of course, our body contains these very nuclear particles that physicists split. And, you know, and this starts to kind of maybe change the story a little bit about us being these separate, isolated individuals. And, you know, and even just through the body, we can start to sense that the very surround around us is not separate, is not at all separate in reality. It's not just something poetic, but quite experientially, literally, you know, we're always connected to all of life and never alone. In an absolute way. So I'm suggesting, as we come to this close, that, you know, recognition and acceptance and enjoyment of a multiplicity of ways of experiencing our body, our mind, and the connectedness of our body, mind, and the connectedness of body, mind to others and to life. So just a few minutes more. We talked about the mold, similar to the mold. A yogi came in the other day reporting after that very still sitting we all had, went and had sort of no idea what to do next. But the stillness was so powerful, nevertheless, it seemed like it didn't matter, which is true. So he got a bowl of miso soup and looked into it, and lo and behold, what did he see? He saw tides and currents and streaming and, you know, impermanence and pulsing, and just, you know, he saw with his eyes experientially what was true about all things. It can be a visual experience, it can be an auditory experience. You know, we can find that sounds break down into little particles, to little waves, just like the body does. That a melody can completely lose its larger arc of rhythm, you know, and instead just be just units of experience on the level of sound vibration. It's often hard to see impermanence, as I was saying before, not to know it intellectually, but to have a deep, intuitive, life-shifting, immediate experience of it. And the reason why is that, you know, to embrace anicca, impermanence, requires a continuous attention to our own vulnerability. Our own vulnerability, that is, if things are changing like that, you know, there's loss, there's change. We have to build a shelter, you know, to mindfully mourn such loss and change. Both in the big ways in our life, you know, when we lose a friend or a parent or a child or a loved one, you know, some catastrophic or just, you know, painful life change. It's important to acknowledge, you know, our vulnerability in that and the mourning, the mindful mourning that we must go through to get closer to this transformative insight of anicca, of impermanence. Louise Erdrich, she's a poet that I read about mold and dust coils and whatnot. She also writes beautifully about grieving. Sometimes you have to take your own hand as though you were a lost child and bring yourself stumbling home over twisted ice. Whiteness drifts over your house. A page of warm light falls steady from the open door. Here is your bed. Fold it open. Lie down. Lie down. Let the blue snow cover you. So we'll leave off here for tonight. Let me see. I think I opened up by talking about... talking about what I thought I was going to be talking about. And what I remember is... the courage of Eddie Aikau. Eddie would go. Keep that as a mantra. You know, when it's difficult, Eddie would go. That's why there's those bumper stickers and T-shirts. And and then again, the stillness to the degree and subtlety of whispering of the stars, through which such stillness and emptiness, we see what's real. We start to see more and more subtlety in the body itself, the body in the body, the pulsations and currents and tides and streamings and flows, and the awareness that itself becomes more subtle for the very seeing of those subtle tides and currents. And, you know, kind of closing with recognizing sometimes the immense power that comes about when form falls away, when the conceptual way we hold ourselves in the world falls away, some indescribable kind of power felt inside or outside, and a certain resistance or fear, you know, what's that going to mean? You know, what it doesn't mean is annihilation. Only thing that's ever annihilated is greed, hatred, and delusion. And so to open... you know, to embrace more impermanence by being mindful of our own vulnerability and learning to wisely to, you know, mourn loss and change. The closer we understand deeply the nature of impermanence, vast joy arises, deep, non-dependent joy and happiness. Thank you.